What does it really mean to be a neighbor?
It's just everyday people, you know? It's just people who are retired. They have a couple hours in the afternoon, so they're going to do patrols. And it's people who are, you know, real estate agents, you know, driving around, like, trying to track how ICE is moving and alert neighbors when things are not safe.
The rise of mutual aid in times of crisis. That's this week on Explain It to Me. New episodes Sundays wherever you get your podcasts.
I got in the water in the very early morning before the sun had risen, and the water was pitch black. I started swimming, and I felt the water hollowing out around me and felt like something really big was swimming below.
I'm Phoebe Judge, and this is Love, a show about the surprising things that love can make us do. More than 100 episodes available now on This Is Love.
Welcome to Switched on Pop. I'm producer Rihanna Cruz.
I'm musicologist Nate Sloan.
Nate, I'm a big movie guy. Coincidentally, on the movie topic, it is the middle of February, and thus we're in the throes of award season, specifically Oscar season. The 98th Academy Awards are less than a month away, and something of note for this year in particular is that the leading Best Picture nominee, the film with the most Oscar nominations of all time, has a pretty heavy focus on music. And I'm talking about Ryan Coogler's Sinners.
Yes.
16 nominations. We've talked about it on the podcast on multiple occasions due to its centering of blues and the African-American musical canon. That was Miles Catton's I Lied to You, a frontrunner for Best Original Song. I love the little G-funk whistle in there. That's probably my favorite part. Sometimes a film's ultimate impact can be measured in its potential to shift the culture in different ways. And since Sinners, a music-focused film, is now officially the most nominated film in Oscar history, I thought today we could take an opportunity to look at some examples from the last 60 or so years in which the world of cinema has influenced the world of music.
I'm so here for it. I mean, if you look at the history of popular music, what really often moves the needle in making a song popular or a style of music popular is it being featured in a film. This goes back to, say, the birth of rock and roll. You know, Rock Around the Clock, that was the first big rock hit.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock. We're going to rock around the clock tonight. Put your glad rags on. Join me.
And it was popular in part because it was featured in a film. So there is such a symbiotic relationship between film and music, and I am super excited to better understand it through digging through a few key examples of that relationship.
Selfishly, this also serves as a Trojan horse for me to talk about movies on a music podcast. But since we are a music podcast, it makes sense to bring in an outside voice, specifically an expert in movies and movie scoring in particular. And that's Vulture's own Fran Hoffner. Welcome to the show, Fran.
Thank you so much for having me.
Fran wrote an incredible piece for Vulture last year titled The Death of the Classic Film Score, which we were trying to tie into an episode for months afterwards here on Switched on Pop. So this is a bit of wish fulfillment.
Yes.
Let's do it. No time like the present.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, I know your piece was about score, but I think that extends to make you an expert in movie music writ large, which is kismet for today's conversation.
Yeah.
So it's worth noting before we get into it, you know, a film score is different than a film soundtrack, but for the sake of our argument, we'll be speaking of both under the guise of music in a movie, this large bucket. And there's previously been examples of movie influencing music and vice versa. Nate just brought up one, Rock Around the Clock. But I'm thinking of something like the era-defining disco of Saturday Night Fever soundtrack. Or one of my personal favorites, rave culture being showcased in the Trainspotting soundtrack with songs like Born Slippy from Underworld, making an indelible impact on underground dance floors everywhere. We currently, of course, live in the era of tie-in movie soundtracks, thinking of Black Panther and Barbie. And today, we're bringing four examples to the table, movies that could serve as a precedent for Sinner's impending impact in the world of blues and R&B. So let's take it back to the year of 1973 and talk about the classic Paul Newman, Robert Redford joint, The Sting. Directed by George Roy Hill, won 7 Oscars, including Best Picture, and was instrumental in bringing back the turn-of-the-century genre of ragtime. Nate, could you put on your musicologist hat for a second? Because I am admittedly unfamiliar with ragtime due to the fact that I'm 26 years old. So can you elucidate for the class what exactly is the genre of ragtime?
Well, to be clear, there's no one alive who is around for the dawn of ragtime at this point. But your point is well taken. There was a time in the beginning of the 20th century when a music arrived that ruffled a lot of feathers, was associated with lewd and lascivious dancing, was seen as a product of African-American subculture, and caught on with white audiences in a huge way, prompting a lot of moral outrage. And that music was ragtime. It sounds like I could be describing jazz or hip hop or rock, but it was ragtime was maybe the first to do it. And when we listen to a song like the one that's featured in the opening credits of The Sting, Scott Joplin's The Entertainer, it doesn't sound that disruptive, but the jagged syncopation of this music, the underlying funkiness, the dissonant harmonies, this was all very threatening to the status quo of American music at the time. Fran, Rihanna, I mean, you can just feel the sense of danger and licentiousness, right? With every gentle piano note of that.
It's titillating.
100%.
I think it makes sense that the filmmakers and the composer, Marvin Hamlisch, would select this music to score the journey of two low-life con men trying to make their big score. It would have been, I think, really appropriate for these dangerous con men to be associated with this dangerous lowdown music.
That's an interesting read, because when I hear The Entertainer and when I hear, you know, Marvin Hamlisch's adaptation of The Entertainer, it doesn't feel radical. It feels very standard and by the book. And maybe it's because, like, in modern contemporary times, like, The Entertainer is used to herald the arrival of an ice cream truck. So, like, I think that impact or rather... that dangerousness is lost in a modern era. And I was honestly quite confused by the choice, but I guess there's an element of playfulness to what you're hearing, and it kind of accompanies this cat and mouse tension in the film.
Joplin was also not especially well known at this time. It was a little bit like bringing someone back who had been kind of lost to an era when publishing and copyright were much muddier than they are now. And so I think in part this felt like a little bit of radical scoring because this style of music had sort of drifted so far from like cultural consciousness. And this is a score, I mean, I associate this film and this music with childhood. I grew up playing piano, and I think Joplin is taught to a lot of piano students as a kind of like first step beyond just doing like dinky little melodies. And his work is quite demanding and quite athletic and requires not only a really good sense of internal rhythm that can be mutable, but also there's a lot of jumping around, especially in your left hand, and a lot of big octave stretches. I have very small hands, so Scott Joplin's music is very rough on me personally. I think of something like The Entertainer, which is ostensibly, I think we'd think of as a kind of classical music or coming out of classical music. But The Entertainer feels like a needle drop, feels like a pop song in the context of this film. And it exists in sort of a weird in-between in film scoring where this is both an isolated song that exists in its own context and also in a bigger, sort of more classical canon.
Wow, Fran, we brought you in as a film expert, but we're already learning you're a secret music expert as well.
Well, I love this. This movie and the score are such a weird anomaly.
Yes.
You know, Marvin Hamlisch wins the Oscar for this, but he's winning the Oscar for arrangements of someone else's music.
What you pointed out is important here too, Fran, because I think it's fair to say that you and so many other piano students, myself included, played pieces like The Entertainer growing up. Thanks to The Sting reviving this composer and his music, it's pretty remarkable. An album of Scott Joplin's piano rags went, I don't have the exact stat, but it was maybe number one on the Billboard album charts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, number one.
It hit number one for multiple weeks.
For multiple weeks.
Like, that feels so crazy.
Yeah,
it really is.
People couldn't get enough of Scott Joplin.
And I feel like this is such a testament to the power of film to change people's musical perspectives, because if I think about like why someone would want to go to listen to Scott Joplin after watching The Sting, is it fair to say it's because they want to keep recapturing that feeling of watching the movie and, you know, staring into Paul Newman's piercing blue eyes and Robert Redford's handsome locks and the excitement of the caper? I don't know. I'm curious if y'all have thoughts on like why people respond to music in this way after seeing it in a film.
I think like oftentimes I feel very moved when I watch a movie in theaters. And recently this happened to me. I was watching the Jim Jarmusch flick Ghost Dog, Way of the Samurai, and the soundtrack is a beautifully curated selection of songs by RZA. Music makes me lose control. Wu-Tang, now we on the roll. On the rise, now here we go. Guaranteed to flip the show. RZA beats is out of control. Out of control. Out of control. And so there's these really detailed textures and soundscapes of urban life. The movie takes place in Jersey. And when I walked out of the theater, I was walking to the bus stop and I was just playing that music. And I just felt like I didn't want to remove myself from the world. So I think when you're so moved by a picture and it moves you so much, you just want to keep those good vibes going.
Yeah, I think The Sting also has a kind of, I've seen the movie so many times and I have great affection for the movie, but it's kind of slow. And it's really kind of conventional.
Yes.
And I think the score gives it a little bit of an edge or something of a calling card that sets it apart from similar films of that time. I think that film in Oscar history was considered kind of a, maybe not Oscar bait the way we think of Oscar bait now, but a very safe choice in all the categories that it won. But I think the score is maybe one place in which it was taking a really big risk.
The success of the soundtrack, I think, is exceptionally interesting when you look at other music of a similar era. The best-selling record the same year as The Sting, 1973, was Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon. So when you look at a record like that and songs like Great Gig in the Sky, next to Scott Joplin, it's fascinating that this was able to catch on. Like, The Entertainer, Hamlisch's version, reached number 3 on the Hot 100 in May of 1974.
Wild.
That's wild.
Yeah.
That's me calling the radio every single day, saying, I need to hear Scott Joplin's The Entertainer.
And because Ragtime and Scott Joplin had kind of been lost to history, The Sting put it back in the public consciousness. It brought its key composer to a new generation. And speaking to Scott Joplin being forgotten, Scott Joplin had died in an unmarked grave. Mm. Then it became marked the year after The Sting won Best Picture. Mm. So people were really tapping in to the Scott Joplin discography. The first Scott Joplin Ragtime Festival in Missouri launched in July of 1974. Mm. And Scott Joplin was given a posthumous Pulitzer in 1976. And would that happen if the Sting didn't have this as a score? Probably not.
So what are some of the other examples from film history where a film has actually kind of moved the needle in terms of changing people's awareness of a composer or even a whole style of music?
We got to flash forward to the year 2000, and I'm talking the Coen Brothers movie, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? The movie, if you're not familiar, is a loose adaptation of the Odyssey, and perhaps has the most distinct connection between the world of film and music as the soundtrack album, won Album of the Year at the Grammys. And it joins an elite list of era-defining soundtracks to win Album of the Year, like the aforementioned Saturday Night Fever in 1979, and the soundtrack for The Bodyguard, which won in 1994 and featured Whitney Houston at the peak of her powers, like on the track I Have Nothing. Don't walk away from me. I have nothing, nothing, nothing if I don't have you. Drag brunches were never the same. But the difference between those soundtracks and Oh Brother, Where Art Thou is that the soundtracks for those movies, The Bodyguard and Saturday Night Fever, were mainly pop music. The Oh Brother soundtrack is a little different in that it's mostly composed of traditional and bluegrass songs, re-recorded by contemporary musicians like Alison Krauss, Gillian Welch, Emmylou Harris, and others. And it's a real who's who of traditional American genres. There's also classic traditional folk staples on the album, like Harry McClintock's Big Rock Candy Mountain recording.
I'm headed for a land that's far away, beside the crystal fountains. So come with me, we'll go and see the Big Rock Candy Mountains.
So a little context on the soundtrack. It was curated by producer T-Bone Burnett, who is known for what the New York Times once called, quote, American magical realism, which I think is interesting because he's worked before with artists like Bob Dylan and Los Lobos, kind of crafting this narrative of what American music is throughout his career. And the soundtrack was made before the film was written, so these tracks serve as a North Star for the direction of the script. And that allows the music to influence the movie rather than, you know, the movie being created first and then people picking music. The New York Times, upon release of the Oh Brother, Where Art Thou soundtrack, called it one of the least mainstream Hollywood soundtracks ever offered for sale. It makes sense to have these songs. The film is set in the Great Depression, and most of the music in the film is diegetic, meaning it's occurring in-universe. And I think of the baptism scene that's set to the track Down to the River to Pray, performed on the album by Alison Krauss.
Oh, brothers, let's go down, let's go down, come on down. Come on, brothers, let's go down, down in the river to
Or when the sirens in the film sing the folk song, Didn't Leave Nobody But the Baby.
Go to sleep, you little 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 baby.
Everybody's gone in the cotton and the corn. Didn't leave nobody but the baby.
The most interesting hit here, though, is the track that the main trio of characters, played by George Clooney, Tim Blake Nelson, and John Turturro, perform early in the movie as the Soggy Bottom Boys, the track I Am a Man of Constant Sorrow.
In constant sorrow all through his days, I am a man of constant sorrow. I've seen trouble all my days.
Banger.
You rock with it, Nate?
Yeah. 20-some years later, I still find it electrifying to listen to.
That's interesting, because I listened to the soundtrack. I watched this movie, and it did not connect with me, mostly because I came to it after this music had its big push, so I was not super invested in what was happening. But I do think the song here is pretty good. It's very tactile. It's very compelling. There's a bare bones instrumentation, but the Greek chorus like backup vocals add a sense of grandeur to it. It's much more rock than anything else on the soundtrack. And I think this is probably the most compelling song in that movie.
I mean, I think this music is great. And I actually hadn't known the extent to which this film was shaped around the inclusion of the music versus writing it and then kind of backfilling, which in that case kind of reminds me of Sinners, which I think also came together in a similar fashion, where like we see Ludwig Göransson as an executive producer, which you don't see for a lot of composers on a film. So I've always really loved how the Coen brothers use music in their films. I maybe don't like the Oh Brother soundtrack more than, say, Inside Llewyn Davis, but I'm always so charmed with how they see music play a role in their work.
This is an interesting example to me because is it fair to say that the soundtrack kind of overshadowed the movie itself?
Definitely.
The movie didn't win Best Picture. I don't even think it was nominated for Best Picture.
It was only nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay and Cinematography. So score blanked. But I think because this is pre-existing music, it kind of self-eliminates. But beyond that, this wound up being more of a kind of cult classic Coen Brothers film than one of their more esteemed pictures.
I'm surprised that the Academy would make them put in the adapted category if it's based on the Odyssey. It's like, isn't that just, I don't know, it's funny to me.
We have to make sure that Homer gets his royalties, I guess.
I remember that. It reminds me of one of Rihanna Cruz's favorite lines ever on the show, which is, the only Homer I know is Simpson.
It's true.
I mean, to give you a sense of what an impact the soundtrack made on me, when I was a freshman in college, there was like a talent show for all the new admits. And I convinced my roommate, Arthur, to play violin and accompany me while I played banjo in a version of this song for like the entire freshman class.
Wow.
And I wore overalls and a coonskin cap and immediately forgot all the lyrics to the song. And it was a really low point. And then everyone was like, hey, are you the guy who forgot all the words to that song at the big freshman talent show? So all to say, this soundtrack made a big impression on me, is I guess what I'm trying to say.
I think the curation of the soundtrack by T-Bone Burnett is particularly interesting because I think the songs on it carry a duality between tracks. Like this track, I Am a Man of Constant Sorrow, has really depressing lyrics. It's very stark in its imagery. That's so haunting and has even more impact when you play songs like that and the folk song Oh Death, which is also on the soundtrack, next to tracks like Big Rock Candy Mountain and You Are My Sunshine. Like, it's perhaps a reason for the album's success. It's such thoughtful sequencing. The fact that this album was conceived first and then the movie later kind of lends it more creative freedom in terms of what it is trying to do. Out of context, the soundtrack might seem like a slight blip in the culture. Like, remember when we all wore overalls and listened to bluegrass music? But much like The Sting, when you put it next to the popular music of the time, there's a certain authenticity to songs like I Am a Man of Constant Sorrow that is necessary. Next to hits of the moment, like Bye Bye Bye. It's drastic and compelling and serves as kind of like a balm to the pop sheen that was happening in the industry at the time.
What do you think filmmakers are calculating when they approach a film like this? Is it a gamble to put the success of your film on basically how much people are going to like the music in it? Like, how do you think filmmakers and their composers, you know, go about making those calculations when they're preparing a film?
I think those relationships are a lot more collaborative than they used to be. What I wrote about when I was researching my piece last year is we now have filmmakers seeking out, first of all, composers who don't come from a classical background, who come from all sorts of musical backgrounds, but composers who they hire to do the thing that they know how to do versus retroactively fit the style of a movie. I always think about when Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross won the Golden Globe for their Challenger score. And they were like, thank you so much to Luca Guadagnino for not telling us to turn the music down. These are not guys you bring onto your project because you want them to play it cool and quiet. They can do cool and quiet, but you kind of want them to go big. And I think increasingly a lot of composers and musicians who work on film scores have a lot more freedom to try stuff out and to be a more collaborative part of how a film is shaped rather than getting, I don't know, a cut of some scenes and like figure out some violins to fit in here.
That's interesting. Right. If we look at the nominees of 2026, I guess there's some other examples of composers from not from that classical world. We have Johnny Greenwood for One Battle After Another. Are there other examples?
We have the case of Hamnet, which Max Richter did an original score for. But the climactic emotional scene in Hamnet uses an old piece by Max Richter, On the Nature of Daylight. And I spoke to him in the fall about it, and he had written an original piece for that climax. And Chloe Zhao came to him and said, I want to use the music that I was using in Temp that we were using on the day that we shot this, which just so happens to be another piece by him, but a piece composed under a completely different context in an original work by him that was like reckoning with the violence of the Iraq War.
Wow.
So not something that we maybe think of as fitting in with Shakespeare, but makes for a really interesting addition to an otherwise new work by a composer who has a really distinctive sound.
So back to O Brother, Where Art Thou, though. Outside of the movie, as we talked about, the soundtrack had a demonstrated impact. It also, much like The Sting, hit number one on the Billboard 200. It went 8 times platinum. And also led to, I think, a widespread acceptance of Americana as a genre, because now artists that previously defied categorization, they didn't necessarily fit into traditional country. Now you could put a label on artists like Gillian Welch and also move bluegrass into the modern era. When we come back from break, we'll have two examples of genres being incorporated into popular culture through their respective movies.
It's time to level the f*** up. I'm Robin Arson, and I light fires. I'm an executive, founder, best-selling author, ultramarathoner, mother, proud Latina, and I'm not done yet. Announcing Project Swagger, my new weekly podcast, Your Transformation Toolkit. I'm going to cut through the noise and give you actionable takeaways each week in under 30 minutes. Elevate your hustle with routines, strategies, and mindset shifts that I have pressure tested. I have burnt down this Beyonce candle, like, all the way to the bottom. We have been trying to manifest. Carbs are not the enemy. I probably have a piece of bread or a bagel with me at all times, and I am not exaggerating. Tune in on February 24th for episode 1, Building the Skill of Self-Talk. This is the foundation. Follow Project Swagger wherever you get your podcasts. Let's go.
Megan Rapinoe here. This week on A Touch More, the one and only Flaje Johnson joins us to talk about leveling up for the WNBA, managing NIL money, and how she's nurturing her music career. We're also taking a closer look at why participation in girls' sports is declining. Surprising, we know. And we're giving some love to Valentine's Day and what it's like dating a pro athlete and who's the best athlete couple of all time. Check out the latest episode of A Touch More wherever you get your podcasts and on YouTube.
This week on Net Worth and Chill, we're joined by Victoria Garrick Brown, former Division I athlete turned body positivity advocate and entrepreneur who's dismantling the lies we've been sold about our worth. From battling eating disorders as a student athlete to building a platform that's reached millions, Victoria's journey is a masterclass in turning personal pain into purpose and profit. She opens up about the real financial cost of chasing beauty standards, why the skinny girl industrial complex is designed to keep us broke and insecure, and how she's built a business around authentic self-worth without selling out her values. We dive deep into the economics of body image, the influencer money game, and what it actually costs to love yourself in a world that profits from your insecurities. Listen wherever you get your podcasts or watch on youtube.com/yourrichBFF.
So in the case of ragtime and bluegrass, those genres became revived through their use on the soundtracks in their particular movies. There's an interesting case here in the 90s where an old genre had been revived through movies, but it was more than just a reappreciation. It was kind of a cultural reinvention. I'm talking about a couple movies here, namely The Mask, which came out in 1994, and Swingers, which was released 2 years later. And I'm talking swing revival. Oh, you gotta jump, jive, then you wear your jump, jive. That was Jump, Jive, and Wail by the Brian Setzer Orchestra. Brian Setzer Orchestra was one of the premier acts of the swing revival movement. And honestly, in hindsight, to me, swing revival feels like a concentrated psyop. It's the mix of classic swing, a la someone like Cab Calloway. Makes you 9 foot tall when you're 4 foot five. Hep, hep. With vintage aesthetics of rockabilly. And I don't really like it, but in the 90s, it was all the rage.
I definitely remember as a child being riveted by the Gap ads that used the soundtrack of Jump, Jive, and Wail and featured Lindy Hop dancing, the acrobatic style of partner dance named for Charles Lindbergh's solo flight across the Atlantic because of the way that the dancers would throw each other in the air and throw each other over their shoulders. I remember seeing The Mask and, you know, being captivated by Jim Carrey at that point, who I believe to be the funniest person alive. And also the soundtrack, it does feel like a weird blip now to look back at this moment and think how like we were all really getting off on big band swing. Fran, what was your experience of this swing revival?
I was a little too young to appreciate the swing revival. I actually haven't seen these films, but I'm broadly anti-swing. I can put that on the record. But my disdain mostly comes from electro swing, which I feel like had a weird revival towards the end of the time that I was in college as a sort of attempt to maybe make a once uncool genre that briefly became cool again and then became uncool, maybe a different kind of cool. And I remember hearing that music and just being like, now what the hell's going on? And sort of going about with my life. But more than other genres or types of music, that this inspired a kind of revival sort of shocks me.
Yeah.
And makes me feel as though I don't understand how history happened.
Well, let me provide a brief timeline of the events that led us to swing revival delusion in America. Jim Carrey's The Mask comes out in 1994, and it's all bright zoot suits and swing. That's the aesthetic of the movie. I think of the iconic image of Jim Carrey, the green face, and the giant yellow suit. And in The Mask specifically, there's an iconic scene with the music of the band The Royal Crown Review and their song Hey Pachuco. Hey, Pachuco! Hey! Summer 4-3, hey! The man's gunning for me. Hey! Blue and white, me walk tonight. Hey! See damn my pride and all the cats coming down east side. Tonight there's no. Then 2 years later, so 1996, we have the movie Swingers, which frames swing music as a small part of a larger lifestyle. It's a classy life with suits, casinos, martinis, and the emotional climax of the film where Jon Favreau, the main character, is getting over his breakup and he's dancing with a very beautiful Heather Graham. It's set to Big Bad Voodoo Daddy. Then also, pause. The names of these bands are so upsetting to me. There's worse ones like squirrel nut zippers and cherry poppin' daddies, which I think is the absolute worst. But Big Bad Voodoo Daddy is definitely like top three worst band names of all time. Anyway, that scene is set to the song Go Daddy O. Most of Swingers isn't swing related, you know, the way that something like Oh Brother, Where Art Thou is centered around traditional Americana music, but it associates swing with being cool in Los Angeles where the movie is set. So you're kind of having this lifestyle connotation along with dancing to swing. And then boom, late 90s America is there. The band called Squirrel Nut Zippers charts the same year as Swingers, 1996, with their song Hell, which I think is one of the better tracks in the swing revival.
In the afterlife, you could be headed for the serious strike. Now you make the scene all day, but tomorrow they'll be held to pay.
What strikes me about that song is that it sounds darker and different than the bright, cheesy sheen of the other songs. Like, I think Squirrel Nut Zippers gets to more of the, perhaps, like, Minnie the Moocher style of swing.
But Minnie had a heart as big as a highway. Oh, howdy, howdy, ho.
Howdy, howdy, ho.
Howdy, howdy, ho.
Howdy, howdy, ho.
I don't know, Nate. Is that considered swing?
Absolutely, yeah. It's a little hard to hear, Rihanna, because you know you are describing some of. I was so into all of these bands as a teen, I guess.
My apologies. Am I insulting your culture? I'm so sorry.
No, I mean, when I hear you say some of these names out loud, I do recognize that they are pretty cringy, as I guess your generation would say. But I think what's cool about this moment to me is I really want to focus on the dance of it all, actually, because I think I love that these films and their soundtracks may have helped people rediscover not only like swing dance, but maybe other forms of partner dance. You know, I think there's so much to be said for the way that people dance with each other in an earlier era. Now I feel if you go out to a club or something, everyone's kind of like doing their own thing, right? It's all like very, you're there like throwing shapes and everyone else is doing their own little thing. But, you know, in an earlier era, you were like dancing with a partner and you had all these pre-choreographed moves that you could do together. And I think there was something really beautiful about that. And so if whatever the foibles of this swing revival were, I think I'm definitely going to praise it for bringing back that kind of resurrection, I guess.
So in 1998, The Gap puts out an ad to the song I played earlier, Jump, Jive, and Wail. Jump, Jive, and Wail eventually nets Best Pop Performance by Duo or Group with Vocals at the Grammys. And the band that is featured in Swingers, Big Bad Voodoo Daddy, is featured in the Super Bowl 33 halftime show alongside Stevie Wonder and Gloria Estefan. Wow. So demonstrated cultural tale coming from Jim Carrey and The Mask. And it's an example of film helping to usher in a micro scene and grow it exponentially. The movement, and I put quotes around movement, had fizzled out by the end of the 90s. People stopped dancing swing, and I can imagine, like, similar to how rock and roll took over big band music, butt rock smothered swing revival. The timelines kind of sync up. But it did bring about a genre that is perhaps even more controversial, as Fran mentioned, electro swing, which turns the good aspects of swing revival, like analog instruments, into synthetic sounds. So film inspiring music, which in turn inspires more music, which in turn inspires a film, because the soundtrack to another more contemporary movie, 2013's The Great Gatsby, features lots of electro swing, including the track A Little Party Never Killed Nobody by Fergie, Q-Tip, and Goon Rock.
I ain't got time for you, baby. Either you're mine or you're not. Make up your mind, sweet baby. Right here, right now is all we got. A little party never killed nobody. So we gonna dance until we...
Whew, that's a tough listen.
I haven't seen Great Gatsby since it came out in theaters, but I've really convinced myself if I rewatched it, I'd be like, it's genius. But then I hear something like that, and I'm like, there's no way. I can't do it. But I've really, like, convinced myself that Baz can do anything.
I really like Baz. I think he's probably the eminent camp director. And I think he's able to, like, access the beauty in derided things. Like, he's so into garish aesthetics that it kind of swings around in, like, horseshoe theory into being genius. Mm. Like, this song is so terrible that I love it, you know?
Yeah, 100%.
Now, Baz did not succeed in making electro swing like a phenomenon with The Great Gatsby, as far as I'm aware.
The Great Gatsby soundtrack has Young and Beautiful by Lana Del Rey, which I remember being a really early big push for Lana,
yeah,
who I had only known from like little blogs at that time.
Will you still love me when I'm no longer young and beautiful? Will you still love me when I got nothing but my aching soul? I know you will.
And I feel like, if nothing else, that soundtrack actually kind of launched her into a kind of legitimacy in a mainstream sort of way.
Well, I'm happy you bring up Lana because I think that gives me a segue into the last movie with modern musical legs. And I invoke Lana because she is a perfect example of, I think, her early work being aesthetic driven and vibe driven. And there's the movie that launched a million Scorpion jackets, and that's the 2011 Nicholas Winding Refn, Ryan Gosling movie, Drive. The score was made by Cliff Martinez, but the real power here is in the soundtrack. It's probably the most iconic soundtrack of recent memory, one lodged firmly in the French house subgenre of synthwave. Mm. I'd like to take a listen to Kavinsky's Night Call.
I'm giving you a night call to tell you how I feel. I want to drive you through the night, down the hills.
One of the most French songs I think I've ever heard. There's just a certain je ne sais quoi. It shifted cornball 80s synthesizer music, aesthetically something that's very bright and bubbly, into something that's very dark and brooding. You know, I think of Depeche Mode as a probable precursor and inspiration for this type of music. And the rise of synthwave kind of dovetails with the rise of Tumblr and other aesthetic-based platforms. Like I said, vibe-driven music. And it fits best when placed in the context of the movie. Like, the movie enhances the power of the music because it's slowly pulsating in the case of Night Call. You know, there's this driving beat to it. And it's placed over the opening credits of Drive, in which you're getting these aerial views of Los Angeles. And it feels like the fitting soundtrack for driving around the city late at night.
There's something inside you. It's hard to explain. They're talking about you, boy. But you're still the same.
This is like the first movie I remember coming out in my lifetime to be really cool.
Yeah.
Like, I remember going to college, and there were like the cool movie posters, like the Fight Club, the like that whole thing. But like, those movies were older. Those had come out like when we were kids. And I felt like Drive coming out was like the first time I was the right age for something that was having a moment in the zeitgeist. And like any wannabe alternative person at that time, I never saw it because I so resented its kind of coolness. But the impact of it at the time was undeniable and completely inescapable. I remember the Halloween after Drive came out, like everyone had that jacket. And I felt like even without having seen the film, that soundtrack, that music was everywhere. I finally saw it in 2019 and was like, this movie's pretty cool. I don't know what I was holding myself back from.
You would think over time the movie would lose some of its coolness, but like every couple of years I revisit it and I'm like, oh no, this is just as dope as the first time I watched it.
It's really awesome.
Yeah.
Like, he is a cool guy and what he did was fine.
You know, so much of that cool factor has to be attributed to the music, I think, and to the visuals, I guess, but certainly not the dialogue. I don't remember if anyone spoke in this movie, honestly. I guess they must have to, like, further the plot. But really, when I think of this movie, all I think of is just, like, people driving in silence, walking slowly with purpose, and this throbbing French house synthwave soundtrack. I feel like it's a testament to how important music is in setting a vibe. And I feel like a lot of filmmakers kind of followed this template afterwards, maybe realizing, like, I don't need to have a ton of plot, a ton of dialogue. We could just have some great visuals and an amazing soundtrack, and it'll just establish kind of a feeling for the audience to really lock into.
Well, I think something interesting about this soundtrack is that the songs, because the driver doesn't talk in the movie, or maybe he has a few lines, but the songs and the lyrics within them kind of speak on behalf of Ryan Gosling's character, because the first lyrics of Night Call include the line, "I want to drive you through the night, down the hills." Like, it's a song about driving. Mm-hmm. And then I think of the inclusion of another song, A Real Hero by College featuring Electric Youth. Yeah. And it could be applied to the main character, telling us, the audience, that he is a hero. He has good intentions, you know, even though his actions might be a little controversial. The movie is successful because of the music. And I think synthwave in particular, because of Drive, has such a long tail in the current canon of popular music. Like, I think, like, contrary to the other movies we talked about, which showcase a short-term revival of a dead genre, or in the case of Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, a promotion of a niche subculture, synthwave is the one that I think has influenced what we hear in the mainstream on a larger grand scale, even in 2026. Some of the biggest pop songs in recent memory are direct descendants of this sound, like Midnight City by M83, which feels like a more optimistic cousin of Night Call. You know, it's the same sonics, the same filtered vocals, but it soars and it grows.
I mean, that's a song that also has made its way into a lot of films and into a lot of film trailers, I think, in part because of the success of something like Drive.
See, but, like, the music and the genre that these bands are making serves itself well for a visual companion, because the songs themselves are cinematic. Like, they grow and deflate and they have climaxes and they serve as kind of like internal hero's journeys when you look at the lyrics of some of these tracks. And, like, it just feels kismet to put them next to visual media.
So what do we think? Is it possible that Sinners or another contemporary film could have the same effect that some of these movies we've been discussing could, in the sense that will everyone start playing Delta Blues after, you know, watching Sinners, seeing it potentially win a record number of Academy Awards? Will this have the same impact of, you know, Brother, Where Art Thou, The Sting, Drive, Swingers? Like, is it still possible even for movies to move the cultural dial in this way when we're, like, as many have argued, we're in a more sort of fractured cultural landscape?
I think soundtracks definitely can, but often independent of awards or accolades. Like, I think the work that Ludwig Göransson has done so far to influence movie music comes far before he did work on Sinners. I think his score for Oppenheimer and I think his work on Black Panther we see kind of trickling down to how things are now. I'd be curious to see where things are 5 to 7 years away. But then I think of something like Challengers, which at least kind of briefly crossed into a mainstream party scene, but like didn't have much success as like a legitimate awards player. It's hard to say. I think these things move a little bit more independently of each other than they used to.
I think with all the soundtracks that we've talked about today, I see two different elements. I see artful curation and I see compelling soundscapes. And I do think Sinners has both of those things. Like the soundtrack and the score is very artfully curated and composed. It sounds new. It sounds refreshing. I think of when I played I Lied to You earlier and it feels like 60 years of black music compressed into one singular song.
Will somebody take me in your arms tonight?
And the soundtrack also has critical acclaim, which I think is important. I could see a young kid picking up a guitar and listening to the blues in that movie being like, I want to be like Sammy.
No, I completely agree. I think that film has done something really remarkable, which is like bridge that which is artful and challenging with that bombastic and thrilling in a way that so few movies are able to do nowadays.
The 98th Academy Awards is on March 15th, so they are a month away, more time for us to think and sit on the beauty of Sinners. And only time will tell if 5 years from now there's a number one blues record and they interview the dude that made it and he says, hey, I watched Sinners and got inspired. That would be lovely.
Switched on Pop is produced by Rihanna Cruz, edited by Lissa Soap, were engineered by Brandon McFarland, and were a production of Vulture and Vox Media Podcast Network. Speaking of Vulture, you can check out more of Fran's brilliant writing if you just head over to vulture.com. And we'll post a link in our show notes to the excellent article we've been discussing in this episode about The Brutalist.
Shout out, Fran. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Such a pleasure. Our illustrations are by Scott Lieb. Our theme music is by Jossie Adams and Zach Tenorio of Arc Iris. You can find us on any social media at Switched on Pop. We have a Substack as well. Check us out there. And our videos are on YouTube. So if you want to look at a podcast instead of listen to it, or maybe do both, you can check them out there.
We'll be back next week with a brand new episode. And until then,
thanks for listening.